Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this program all about culinary history. And you know, with the numbers of new Peruvian restaurants opening across the country in the U.S., Peruvian cuisine appears to be the new darling of the restaurant world these days, and a little wonder why. The food is interesting as it is diverse. According to a recent article on the background of Peruvian gastronomy in the Journal of Ethnic Foods, the authors state that it is one of the most diverse cuisines in the world, consisting of an extensive variety of distinctive dishes characteristic of each city in the country. Peruvian gastronomy is shaped and strengthened by all the cuisines that exist throughout the country, as well as the Peruvian biodiversity that provides the foundation for a wealth of recipes, techniques, and flavors. And this has been a long time coming. I would say, let's say, in the making, ancient Peruvians domesticated many of their indigenous foods that have endured until today, such as potatoes, corn, tomatoes, peanuts, beans, sweet potatoes, quinoa, and fruits that originated since the dawn of ancient Peru. To help shed some light on the cuisine and culture of the country, I have as my guest today Robert Bradley, the author of a new book titled Eating Peru, a Gastronomic Journal. Bob Bradley started out as a wine merchant for New York City's most acclaimed restaurants until a trip to Central America put him on the path to studying Mesoamerican art history and archaeology at Columbia University. He is now an associate professor at the School of Art and Design at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. His meticulously researched book, Eating Peru, is the product of 25 years of, as he says, exquisite digressions from his real job, the culmination of decades of his personal discoveries about the food of Peru and the history that led to its current culinary status. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you so much, Linda. Thank you for having me.
First of all, tell us a bit about your journey and where your life has brought you and how you came about writing this book.
Sure, Linda. I mean, I live in Texas now, but I actually grew up in an Italian neighborhood in New Jersey. And one thing led to another. I got out of the military, and I had been drinking wine underage, on, you know, I guess fortunately or unfortunately, since I was a child and teenager, let's put it that way. And I decided to go in the wine business, and the business led me to selling to, you know, high-end restaurants in Manhattan and New Jersey. And I really enjoyed the business for a while, but after a time, I became a little burnt out. It was going into the 90s, and I think it became a little more corporate. That would have been my next step, and I didn't want to do that. I loved boutique wines and telling the stories. So I took a vacation down to Belize, and I watched these archaeologists working at a ruin called Zanantinich. And I said, I want to do that. So I made a journey up to Colombia. I talked with Esther Pastore, who later became my advisor. And one thing led to another, and I went and got my PhD in art history and archaeology. Initially, she was a Mesoamericanist, but she turned me towards the Andes, in particular, Chachapoyas culture of northeastern Peru, which is a very difficult place to work. I mean, foot-deep mud, you know, jungle-covered mountains, that sort of thing. So when I came down to the coast, which had this vibrant food culture, and I would sit around and think, wow, this is so amazing. How come I don't know about this? And after a while, my writing started to focus on the history and foods in Peru. And that's led me to where I, you know, where I am today. And it's sort of a difficult journey, but I'm glad I got here.
Uh-huh. Well, you've said that Peru's location makes it a gastro center. Explain about why it's a gastro center.
Well, I mean, I think you find any of these like ancient places in the world, and what jumps to mind is maybe China and Egypt, and certainly Mesoamerica with Mexico City, and with Peru. I mean, they had these ancient cultures where people started cultivating, as you've said in your introduction, cultivating things very early on. And, you know, and also a lot of these centers have sort of unique geography. Maybe it's a river, maybe it's something like that. But Peru, it's the Peruvian, you know, current. It's there, the Peruvian Trench and the Humboldt Current off the coast, where Peru has the most prolific maritime environment of probably any place in the world. So you have these factors that really helped it grow, and along with ancient civilizations. I mean, Corral is the oldest city in the Americas. The archaeologist Ruth Shoddy worked there, and it dates back to 2650 BCE. That's contemporaneous with Old Kingdom Egypt. So you think about just the antiquity of the civilization there, along with the abundant natural resources, and it all, you know, has this, it all turns into this incredible gastronomic tradition, along with the influx of different peoples and different cultures over time.
Right. Well, that's interesting too. I mean, you know, someone says Peru to me, and I'm sure as many people, you know, I think, oh, yeah, Machu Picchu and, you know, potatoes. And then, of course, I think, oh, yeah, Spanish conquest. Well, there has been so much influence from different cultures in Peru. Kind of give us a little timeline over what's happened to the cuisine over time with these different invasions, travelers, immigrants, et cetera.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess you could say the first immigrants were people that came over on the Asian land bridge, and they worked their way down to the tip of South America. So they're coming in, and those dates keep changing. They keep getting older and older and older. So Your first immigration of humans, you know, gets in there, you know, 20,000 years ago, maybe longer. So, you know, you have that. And then the pre-Columbian world, of course, has... You know, when I teach classes, I mean, mostly people want to know about the Inca because the Inca had this vast empire. Mm-hmm. But that's like layers of an onion. I mean, there's so many civilizations that predate the Inca, you know, in ancient Peru. I mean, some of the coastal places, as I said, go back to 2650 BCE. So you have all these different civilizations with different nuances to them. And then you have the invasion, the arrival of the Spanish, which, you know, takes place in the 1530s. You know, with the coming of the Spanish, you have the pre-Columbian exchange.
Right.
So basically, some things go back to Europe. I mean, the most famous would be the potato, corn. You know, corn is people fight over corn. Corn initially probably came from, you know, Mexico, but I mean, certainly the corn was cultivated at a very early time in South America also. But that's one of these discussions that anthropologists yell at each other at conferences, so I'll stay out of that. But definitely the potato and another hot peppers, and another one that's very, very, very important is the tomato. I mean, the tomato makes its way over there, and that's sort of a convoluted story. But some things go back, but a lot of things come in because the Spanish wanted to have their own foodstuffs. When the conquerors arrived, they basically fed on the same thing that the indigenous population ate because it was good, nutritious food. But they wanted the things that they were used to at home, like all of us. I mean, we're used to eating things that we grew up with. And that's the same thing with them. So, you know, they started bringing over things like wheat. I mean, you know, Cieza de Leon, who's an expert chronicler, wrote in the 1550s that, you know, there were wheat fields already planted all over the place in Peru. And, of course, grapes and olives, and they bring over the different animals, the pigs. They brought over the beasts of burden to negotiate the Andes because the Europeans never got used to, you know, hiking in the mountains the way the indigenous populations did. I mean, they're almost physically different. So that was one of the first. And then, you know, after a time, after the Spanish are there, you start getting into the Republican era when Peru moves away from Spain. And, you know, then they also brought in, you know, enslaved people. And enslaved people had a profound impact on Peruvian foodstuffs. I mean, for instance, a lot of the things that are cultivated, like grapes and olives and sugarcane, you know, I left out sugarcane. The indigenous population did not know how to farm those things. So the Spanish would bring in African slaves who learned this trade, learn how to farm these things, Canary Islands and other places. And they came over, and these were the people that cultivated and started, you know, the viticulture, for instance, on grapes. So they came in, and, you know, right around 1830s or 1820s, Peru outlawed slavery. And during that time, after they outlawed slavery, they still needed people to work different things. In the 19th century, what was really important was the guano, the bird droppings on the islands off the coast, which they used at the time to make nitrates. I mean, the formula to make synthetic fertilizers wasn't invented until the late 19th century by a couple of Germans. So what they use is they use the bird droppings to make fertilizers, which was a worldwide industry. And also sugarcane. I mean, sugarcane's incredibly labor-intensive production. So they needed a workforce. And what they did was they made a deal in Macau, because Macau was like the Wild West, to bring over Chinese coolies, Chinese workers. And the workers came in at that time. I mean, it was almost 98% male workers. That's important because after a while, they just disappeared into the indigenous population. They took on a lot of times indigenous wives. And that's why you see a good friend of mine, for instance, his name is Ricardo Sulim Wong. I mean, just think about that name. I mean, in itself, it's just fantastic.
And this obviously came out through the some of the dishes and the foods as well.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. I could get back to that, you know, in a second, but I just want to do the different waves of immigration. But certainly the Tushan, the Chinese Peruvians, which were mostly Cantonese speakers, they came over. They were almost in slave-like conditions in the beginning, but little by little, they had their own storehouses and then their own like little bodegas. And then they started their chifas in Peru. And now if you go to Peru, there's chifas, Chinese Peruvian food, all over the place. You could go into a little village and you're going to have a Chinese restaurant. I mean, it's just, you know, incredible. Now, Japanese came over at the beginning of the 20th century. And, you know, these are the Nikkei people. Initially, they came over as workers, but then they quickly got into textiles. And then, you know, after a time, they also assimilated, although some of them kept distance from the Peruvian culture, but definitely they had a profound impact on Peruvian cuisine. I mean, and I think it kind of reached its height with Alberto Fujimori, you know, who was, a Nikkei. Well, at one point in time, he said he was born in Peru. And at another point in time, when he was arrested, he said he was born in Japan. So who knows what the story is on that. But then you had the Japanese come in. And then also around that same time, the turn of the 19th century into the 20th, you had Italian immigrants come in. Now, the Italian influence on Peruvian food is not as profound, but it is still there. During the Peruvian Fiestas Patrias, their Independence Day, and at Christmas, you'll see panettone, the Italian fruitcake, all over the place. They have some imported. There's also have their own brands, D'Onofrio, that they make there. So panettone's very, very popular. And this will give you insight that a lot of the Italian immigrants that came in, and it would be 1/10, maybe 1/20 of the population of the Chinese, you know, immigrants that came in. But they actually came from northern Italy, from, you know, the area, you know, of, you know, the north coastal towns, the northwestern coastal towns of Italy. So, I mean, that's the waves of immigration that basically had this profound effect of on Peruvian cuisine.
That's, I mean, it's phenomenal and not unlike a lot of other lands, but this happened so early in their cultures. You had mentioned the planting of wheat, and that brings me to one asking about something that was, I assume, indigenous to their land, and that was quinoa, and how that was such an important crop for them.
Yeah, quinoa was a very important crop to the Inca, I mean, for sure, and to the pre-Columbian people. I mean, it never took on with the Spanish. I mean, you know, they used different terms for it, like rice, but it was seen, and this was purely prejudicial, but it was seen as inferior to the crops that the Spanish had. And of course, we know nutrition-wise, that's just been wrong, but right. I mean, that wasn't really figured out, I would say, until almost the mid-20th century. You know, Emma McDonald's written stuff about the quinoa boom, because now it's a decade ago, it became so popular that, you know, it was exported all over the world. Peruvian quinoa just became just something that everybody wanted, as they should, because the nutritional value. This got the campesinos, the people in the highlands that were growing it, that they started to feed their children rice instead of quinoa because they were selling the quinoa for a higher price. And of course, a lot of their children became malnourished because they just didn't have the same thing that they used to. So, yeah, it's fascinating. But quinoa was not one of those things that just early on, you know, became popular. And it's a shame because, as I said, if you're looking to eat something nutritious, there's very few things in the world that are better than that.
Right, right. You know, it's the country is so, I would say, long and narrow. But I mean, you look at a map, and there is this, you know, this snake of a country that, you know, from north to south, are the farming trends a lot different, or they're the types of crops that grow different? Tell me a little bit about that.
I would say the major difference, I mean, Peru, if you can imagine it, is this country with this coastal, with this coast that has this freezing cold Humboldt Current, which comes up from Antarctica, and this most prolific maritime environment. So anything on the coast is, it's fish, it's mariscos. I mean, you know, that's just natural. Uh-huh. And remember, the coast is a desert. So it's a dry, dry desert. But if you irrigate that desert, you can grow anything. I mean, you have to irrigate it, but as soon as you do, you can grow anything. And then you get the foothills of the Andes and going up into the Andes. And the Andes, I would say that's where the different things that you cultivate is radically different, because altitude plays a major factor in what you're going to grow, what you're going to plant. You know, for instance, things like tarwi. Tarwi is a legume, you know, same sort of wonderful nutritional value as peanuts, maybe more. But tarwi, even though it's so nutritious, it's got to be grown in the highlands. I mean, you can't grow it in the lowlands. It's just, it's not adapted to it. So, you know, if you're looking to get tarwi, which again is an esoteric crop, you might find it in health food stores here. I mean, you can buy it online. I mean, it's a pain in the neck to make. You have to rinse it, you know, for 7 days, and you have to boil it. That's because the plant's very natural. It's got its own natural poisons, you know, so it hasn't been cultivated to the point where it's a vulnerable plant and you have to use pesticides and fertilizers to make it grow. But something like that won't grow at sea level. I mean, at sea level, though, along the coast, the Peruvians can grow just about anything.
And what about potatoes? I mean, I read that there were up to 3,800 varieties of potatoes.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I study this stuff, and I'm still confused on how many there are. Huh. You see, a lot of textbooks say 400, others say thousands. I would say probably thousands. You're probably closer to right than the other one. So the potato is a survival food. And I have to admit this, as an Andeanist, I don't really love potatoes. And everybody will say, oh, no, you love potatoes. And it's like, no, I don't think most people do. I think they love the salt. I think they love the oil, you know, that you fry them in. I think they love the caviar that you put on them, or the chives, or the sour cream. I mean, come on, you have to dress up the spud because it's a potato. I mean, you know, that being said, it is an incredible survival food. I mean, in the Andes at high altitude, you know, the thing is prolific. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And potatoes, one variety of potato came over to the New World, and it profoundly changed Western European culture to the point where there were wars that were just fueled by potatoes. Mm-hmm. There are some historians that say the European conquests throughout the world would not have taken place if it wasn't for the potatoes, you know, the potatoes. So it's really amazing. And also when you go into a supermarket, when you look at all these different sub-varieties of potatoes that we have, they're all one variety of potato. Now, the problem with that is the potato came over and it was cultivated. It became a monoculture, one particular type. And when you do that in nature, there's all these things that are going to want to eat it, especially if people start playing around with it and they start taking the potatoes that aren't as bitter, and the bitters are, means toxins. So they start cultivating ones with less and less toxins, which takes the natural defenses away from the plant. And then pretty much you have this big, like baby-like thing, you know, this big potato in a field that you have to put fertilizers in and pesticides, or else everything else will eat it. And, you know, the monoculture isn't good in the fact that, you know, there's not diversity in it. It's not a good thing, which is interesting because even to this day in Peru, I mean, I put a little piece in my book, you know, certain Bolivian indigenous group are still trying potatoes, different varieties of potatoes, and tasting them. The ones that are less built are so bitter, so they're still trying to cultivate wild tubers, which is fantastic. Yeah. And if you go to there's a chain called La Lucha, which makes these wonderful sandwiches in Peru. They also have Huayro potatoes. Huayro potatoes are a semi-wild potato that they actually make French fries with. So these potatoes will have less pesticides, less fertilizers. They're more natural. So, you know, and of course, I could go into the history, the potato famine in Ireland. That was it's a monoculture. Yeah, and, you know, a lot of people believe that the blight that came over in the fertilizers, which I talked about earlier, which were shipped over to Europe. You know, there was a disease in that which wiped out the potatoes in Ireland.
It's amazing how one particular plant, one particular vegetable, if you will, could control so much. Also, there were the peppers. You mentioned the peppers, and I didn't realize that peppers were. I mean, certainly I knew there were the peppers in the cuisine, but I didn't know that it was such an important part of the agriculture there.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, there's in particularly four types of Peruvian peppers, which for the most part aren't anywhere else in the world, okay? So the one ají limo, or what would be fructicens or chinesa, which that we do have that here. That would be habaneros, like things like right. that. It's a pepper that originated in the South American forests. So that they do have. But the other ones, ají amarillo.
Right.
Ají amarillo is not hot. And it's actually not yellow. It's actually orange. I've got some growing in my backyard because it's the only way I can get fresh stuff here. I actually brought some seeds from Urubamba. I hope that doesn't get me in trouble. But I love the taste of fresh ají amarillo. You can buy it frozen or you can buy it in a jar in the States, but it's not the same thing. So this is mostly used as a flavoring agent from everything from sudados, which are seafood stews, to cabrito, Norteño, which is this wonderful kid goat stew, but it's a flavoring agent. They range between like 4 to 6 inches long, and as I said, they're orange. So and they're not hot. The one that is really really wonderful that I love ají amarillo, but I mean keep in mind it's something that you see mostly in the kitchen. You won't see chopped up on a table or made into a salsa. But is rocoto, and rocoto is actually Capsicum pubescens is the scientific name for it. It looks like a little bell pepper, and they run the same colors like yellow and red and green, but it's not. It's hot. It's super hot. And it's got these black seeds to it that are really wonderful. I can't grow ricottos here. And ricotto is a Quechua term. It's a Quechua name, actually. So it's got one of the original names. I mean, one of the weird things in Peru is they don't use the term chile, obviously not hot pepper. They use ají. And ají is actually a Carib word that came with the Spanish to Peru. So they're actually use a word for hot peppers that came in with the Spanish from another culture in the Caribbean. I mean, and that's used ubiquitously throughout Peru. It's used everywhere except in the highlands. Some of these real isolated highland villages, they use the Quechua term for hot pepper, which is uchu. And also, as I said, rocoto is a Quechua term.
And I know that you also included a very simple, very delicious sounding recipe in your book for the ricotto, the stuffed ricotto.
Oh, yeah. Stuffed ricottos are something that are very famous. There's a style of them in Cusco, and then there's another style of them in Arequipa, you know, the city to the south. But ricottos, the easiest thing to do is you just take the seeds out and you take it as much as the veins you want to leave in. Remember, they're really hot. Put them in a blender with a little lime juice and some salt, and it's an amazing smell. It's an amazing salsa to use on almost anything.
Ooh, all right. Well, speaking of a salsa, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about actual dishes and some of the dishes that have still remain from ages ago, and some new ones. So stay tuned. Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Bob Bradley. He's the author of Eating Peru, A Gastronomic Journey. And Bob, I want to talk about some of the particular dishes. And if there were one dish that you would pick out that you think identifies Peru for its cuisine, what would you say it is?
Well, that's easy. It's ceviche. And, you know, the Peruvian government was working on a UNESCO project for a few years. And the first dish that they came up with was ceviche because it's so Peruvian. Now, Peru makes the best ceviche in the world. I'm biased. My wife's Peruvian, so I couldn't say otherwise. But I do really believe that. I mean, it's fantastic.
So you would say that's a national dish, you would say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and again, it goes back to that Humboldt current, that cold current coming up from Antarctica, which produces the most prolific fishing grounds in the world off the coast of Peru. I mean, if you look at where Peru is, you think if you're going to go down there, bring my bikini or bring my bathing suit. But no, the water's frigid. I mean, until an El Nino comes in once every 10 years or so and pushes the cold water out. But that's a whole nother story. But anyhow, it's just the prolific fishing grounds. So there's so many things that have come out of, you know, that area for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And the hallmark of great ceviche is super fresh fish. I would say, without a doubt, most of these coastal villages in the market, you can buy fish there that's fresher than even the most high-end restaurant or high-end markets in New York or Los Angeles or Miami.
I noticed you didn't say Tokyo.
Tokyo? Yeah, I would say Tokyo, too. I mean, well, I'll mention something that's like that. What's it? Tedeschi, the great market that they have in Tokyo, which is Terminal Santa Rosa. I'll get to that in a second. But the fish that comes out, that's just, there are still pre-Columbian fleets of boat, Cabalitas de Tortora, which are these reed boats that go back to the pre-Columbian era. They're made out of reeds. They're same manufacturer for thousands and thousands of years. The only thing they do differently today is they stuff them with empty soda bottles and wrap the reeds in nylon. And that's just to keep them going longer, because reed boats like become unseaworthy after a while.
Yeah, you have a picture of them on the cover of your book. That's nice.
Yeah, they get waterlogged. But with my mother-in-law, for instance, I used to wait in Pimentel until the fleet came in, and you could buy fish right from the fishermen. I mean, you know, you'd run out there and you'd get a grouper, which they use the term miro in Peru. You get a fish like that. And you're dealing with restaurateurs who are buying directly from these boats. Now, Terminal Santa Rosa is just an incredible place. It's on the north coast. It's near the city of Chiclayo at a little town called Santa Rosa. But that's where all the northern barks come in, you know, the fishing boats. And they basically have, it's a giant covered truck stop that's just tractor trailers and lots of blue bins. And they take the blue bins and they unload the fish, and you're able to buy retail before the fish get thrown on the tractor trailer and get taken to Lima. And that is some of the freshest fish in the world. I mean, I've been there. If you go there, anyone can go in there. I mean, you know, tourists if you want to, but you'll get ignored until the Peruvians inside know you're ready to spend 50, 100, maybe more than that on a fish. And these are huge, beautifully just fresh caught fish. Things like ojo de uva, which is Medusa fish, schnook, which is a robalo, linguado, which is flounder. I mean, you'll see these incredible fish. Mm. And then there's a cleaning station there that you can get the fish clean. You can get your fillets and keep your fish head if you want to make a nice soup. And they'll do it all for about $2.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know this was interesting to a lot of the Japanese culture, and I'm intrigued by the Nikkei culture. And there are actually a couple Nikkei Peruvian restaurants here in New York City. And what influences in particular and how it comes out in some of this Nikkei? This is a Japanese Peruvian cuisine.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, that again is easy. I mean, Maido is, I think, number 6 of the best restaurants in the world. Central, which is Virgilio Martinez, is this number 1. But just to show you, Peru has 2 restaurants in the top 10, which is amazing. And Maido is classic Nikkei tradition. The Nikkei tradition just slips in little things like soy. The Nikkei chefs say that they were responsible for the ceviche in Peru being just dusted with lime and then served, because they say, you know, in the older eras, they used to drench it in citrus juice, which at the time was bitter orange. It wasn't key limes, which mm-hmm. it is today. I mean, the bitter orange tree is almost extinct in Peru, but there is one place you can go. And they used to keep it for hours. And that's mostly true when you talk about Lima. If you go to the north coast of Peru, though, people have been eating raw fish there for since pre-Columbian times. Valderrama, you know, the writer, chronicles that pretty well. He calls it lunch on an oar, where the fishermen would pull out a fish and fillet it and just eat it right off the oar. So they have a tradition which I think is very ancient. But definitely with Limeño culture, the Nikkei influence was profound on that. And also using things like soy sauce, panza fruit, different things like that.
Mm, okay.
When you look at it, Nobu actually came to Peru in the 1970s, and he actually really learned a lot of his craft as being a chef in Peru. So if you look at one of the earlier ambassadors of Nikkei cuisine, it would be Nobu Matsuhisa. Mm. I mean, it's you know, look at all those restaurants. I mean, it's really remarkable. But the Nikkei tradition is still alive and well. There are other – Maido will probably be a tougher place to get a reservation for, but there are a number of like very, very, very good Japanese Peruvian restaurants, you know, in Lima. And they do center more on Lima, where you'll see chifas all over the place in Peru. But I would say when you see Nikkei cuisine, you think Lima.
Huh. Well, I'm also curious about some of the ancient dishes that were made with some of the indigenous vegetables. Because I got hooked on reading a lot about the representations of them in the ceramics of the Mochi culture.
Mm-hmm.
And one was big squash, and another one was a big cucumber.
The squash is easy. I mean, it's loche, and loche is amazing. It's actually a squash that's only grown in the area around Chiclayo in northern Peru. That's it. Hmm. In my book, I actually have a conference notes from there's a group of squash specialists that meet every year. I forget the scientific name for it. Something like Kirubita, I think is the name for squash. But anyhow, there was a paper that came out of there where it's loche squash is cultivated in one spot in the world and that's it. And they noted it. They really noted it. Loche is very, very interesting. If you cut it open in a cross section, really good loche, there's basically no seeds that you see, and it's a bright orange on the interior. They use it to make stews. Basically, Cabrito Norteña is most famous for using loche. With my wife and my kids, we used to stay 3 hours south of Chiclayo at a place called Huanchaco, which is near the town of Trujillo. My mother-in-law would carry a loche squash on the bus with her because she couldn't buy it readily in Trujillo. That's how just centralized loche squash is. Wow. And she would never make loche, or she'd never make cabrito without loche because she said the sauce would taste like water.
Is there anything you could compare it to, like a pumpkin or a butternut?
A pumpkin. I actually, Ricardo Sulim Wong, who is the owner of a Mococho restaurant in Huanchaco, which is this wonderful, Chinese Peruvian restaurant. Alberto Fujimori used to fly his helicopter up there to have lunch. That's how good the place is. He actually calls it pumpkin, when he translates it into English, but he said it has this, different tropical fruit flavor to it. It's just an amazing thing. And by the way, loche has been cultivated in Peru, on the North Coast, for 10,000 years.
Wow.
There's actually records of it. So, just to give you the idea of the ancientness. As far as that dish making cabrito, the cabrito norteño, which is so famous throughout Peru, that's pre-Columbian. Of course, the cabrito, the goats aren't. But what they probably used, and you see it in Moche ceramics, which you mentioned, which is really, they have a wonderful ethnography of some foodstuffs. They actually have loche squash. They made ceramics out of loche squash. That's how much the Moche love loche. But they probably used either dog or deer in the recipe.
Oh, interesting.
So that would be a pre-Columbian dish. Another pre-Columbian dish was probably the ceviche. Was probably made, of course, the lemon sutil doesn't come in. That's something that comes through, brought in by the Moors to Spain and, the key lime. It's got an interesting history of its own, but that doesn't come in until the conquest. But we do have maracuyar, which is passion fruit. So pre-Columbian ceviche was probably passion fruit mixed with fish. And I would say I made that once for my family. I used ojo de uva, which is a firm white fish. I actually love the fish. It's the Medusa fish. But that doesn't work so well because the maracuyar, the passion fruit, overpowers it. But if you take some of these smaller, more oily fishes, it blends perfectly well. And that would be mostly what they caught. Because you have to remember when you're using cotton fishing line, it's really hard to bring in big time fish. That's difficult. It's hard enough to do a nylon line. With cotton, it's pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we move on, and I know I can get it right in there with you on the digressions, believe me, but I think we would be remiss if we did not talk about pisco. And you mentioned, grapes coming in, but tell me about pisco and the pisco grapes and pisco and what it is, describe it for everyone. I actually have some sitting on my counter, but it's not that common for people.
It's amazing because I know as I say this more and more, I'm going to price myself out of the pisco buying market because I think pisco is the most undervalued spirit in the world, period. End of discussion. I mean, the history of pisco, it comes in with the Spanish. The grapes are mostly planted in southern Peru. So around the port area of Pisco, that's where it gets its name. As I said, a lot of the viticulture was done with enslaved people, African people, you know, doing the Pisco and, you know, growing. And by the way, I want to put that, my next research project is doing a book on Pisco. Huh. So I want to put that in, some of that neglected history, see what I can find down there. There's five major growing areas. They're all in southern Peru. The grapes that they put in there 500 years ago are basically very, very sweet grapes. And the growing conditions are really interesting. Again, it's a desert and needs to be irrigated. But these super sweet grapes, when they make them into wine, the wine is obviously very sweet. But if you distill the juice from you or the wine from these grapes, what you have is you have a liquor that doesn't have a bite to it. Like, for instance, Armagnac and Cognac are made from a grape called Uni Blanc, which does not have a lot of sugars in it. So, you know, after you distill, you know, the product of those grapes, I mean, you have to age it. If you don't, it's going to be too fiery and hard to drink. It's the exact opposite in Peru. As a matter of fact, in Peru, it's illegal to call it pisco if you age it in wood. You're not allowed to age it in wood, you know, so that's like out of the question. Out of the grapes that are there, the typical one is Quebranta. Quebranta's grown all over the place. The other ones, they have aromatic grapes. And these grapes are basically make piscos that you should sip. You know, you shouldn't make a pisco sour. And they are Torrontel, which is Torrontes, Muscatel, Moscato, Italia, which has its own history. It's very hard to define what that one is. And there's Albia, which is very, very rare. You don't see that. And what's the third? Negro Criolla is the other one. And these are aromatic. So these should be, you know, sipped. Huh. You'll also see things on some Pisco labels that'll say Mosto Verde. And what happens is if you compare Pisco to Grappa, Grappa is made from the leftovers after you make wine.
Right.
And Grappa is pretty expensive. Pisco is made from wine. So, you know, as far as Europe would go, that's almost out of the question that you would make a product like that. You would lose your shirt. You can't do it. And it takes three bottles of Pisco or of wine to make every bottle of Pisco. So run that number by your head. It's astronomical. Well, Mosto Verde is they make the Pisco out of wine that hasn't fully fermented. So it's really sweet wine. And it takes five bottles of wine, you know, to make one bottle of Mosto Verde. That's why Mosto Verde is more expensive. And if you do see it again, that's not something I would mix a Pisco Sour out of.
Right. So what about the famous Pisco Punch?
Oh, the Pisco Punch. Yeah, the Pisco Punch was the precursor to the Pisco Sour. It was a super famous at the Bank Exchange, which was a bar along the same block where the Transamerica Pyramid is in San Francisco. And at the time, and I'm talking about 1880s to Prohibition, people would search out the Bank Exchange just to have a Pisco Punch. I put a recipe in there that was actually recovered by a few researchers, but it's basically pineapple juice and a gum syrup and lots of Pisco. Some people thought that they might have put cocaine in it. I read one book where they said that's not possible because cocaine wasn't invented or wasn't synthesized in the 1880s. Yes, it was. It was actually synthesized in 1865 by a German chemist. Hmm. But I'm not so sure about that one. But Rudyard Kipling said that when you drank it, you saw cherubs and little winged angels fly around. The Bank Exchange had a rule that you had to have one or two, and then you had to walk around the block, which was a huge city block, and then they would evaluate whether you could have another one. So it was a very, very famous drink.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was all that Bay Area thing. The interesting thing is that the Pisco Sour comes out of the Morris Bar in and by the way, the Pisco Punch got shut down because the Bank Exchange got shut down with Prohibition. But, you know, in the 20s, the Pisco Sour comes out of the Morris Bar in Lima. And it's by someone from the Bay Area, actually, an American who comes up with this recipe. And, you know, it's lime juice, a simple syrup, egg white, you know, shaken, you know, not, you could put it in a blender, but you should actually shake it.
It's yeah.
With a little bit of bitters on the top. These days in Peru, you'll see it made with 3 shots of Pisco. Typically the type of Pisco, like I said, you want to use Quebranta, or you'll see another type of Pisco, Achelada. And that means it's 2 blended Piscos, maybe aromatics with Quebranta. But those are the two that you really want to use to make your Pisco Sour.
Interesting.
Typically less expensive and less aromatic.
Well, and then we have the chicha, the corn beer, which is popular throughout, right?
And yeah, I mean, chicha is, you know, it's a fascinating subject. If you go to the highlands, I mean, even people that are just doing the typical trip to Machu Picchu and then back to the States, or back to Lima and then the States, I mean, chicha's all around them. What they have to look for is they have to look for a big pole coming out of a house with a red bag at the end, plastic bag. And that means that the woman of the house, and it's typically in the highland, it's the women, she just made a batch of chicha and she's selling. So what you do is you're taking a taxi to where you want to try it. Just say, hey, stop here for a second. Go in and do your deal. It's not going to be that much money. And you'll have the chicha. Now, highland chicha is light in alcohol. It's, you know, fermented very lightly. I would say it's like 2-3%, something like that. It has a consistency of, Peruvians make oatmeal. What they do is they make oatmeal and then they strain out all the oats and then they drink that liquid. Chicha has almost that same consistency of like a thickness.
Yeah.
Drink. Yeah. It's not something you really want to drink a lot of. I mean, it's a bad hangover. Lots of sugars in there. It just can drive your head crazy.
Oh, that and Pisco. I mean, that they're going to really send us off.
Pisco, right? The Pisco is pretty pure. I mean, you're definitely safer with that. The interesting thing is the North Coast, again, has a different tradition. And it dates back to, I would say, right around 1000 AD when there was this rich king who came into the North Coast, and one of his servants was his beer maker. And they actually record the beer maker. And the North Coast, they still have traditions, which sometimes it's not the women all the time, it's men making the beer. You know, the individual who made the beer for the king, Nilop, was a man. And it tends to be fermented all the way through and aged a bit. And you can still find chicha like that on the coast. They actually age it in wine bottles or whatever kind of bottles they have. And to me, that reminds me of Oloroso sherry, something along those lines. Huh. But it's a very, very different tradition. Mm. Of course, a lot of people have immigrated from the mountains down to the coast. That started in the 1960s. So you'll see, even these days, mostly highland chicha, a lot of it being sold in these villages.
Mm. Well, this is just so much information and so much more that we could talk about. But I encourage people, if you're interested in Peruvian cuisine, to pick up the book, Eating Peru, A Gastronomic Journey by Robert Bradley. And Robert, thank you so much for giving us all this history and information on Peru, the background of Peruvian cuisine. It's really intriguing. And I've enjoyed talking to you.
Linda, it was my pleasure. I mean, I love talking about this stuff. So,
and thank you all for listening to A Taste of the Past. I'd like to thank my engineer, Liam Werner, and Heritage Radio Network. You can get Taste of the Past on just about any listening platform where you get all of your podcasts, so you listen to a variety more. Okay? And see you next time. A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.